thanks for listening to another episode of Project Zion. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Carla Long, and I'm so happy to reintroduce a previous host and guest on the show, Seth Bryant. Seth, it's good to have Carla. You back.
Well, thank you.
Just recently, Seth has had a major change in his life, which I'll let him tell you about. But before this major change happened, I heard Seth present to the Utah Valley Historical Society in Provo, Utah, about the history of Community of Christ in Utah, and I thought, wowie kazow, what a great podcast topic! So I begged and begged for just an hour of his time so that he could tell us about the history of Community of Christ in Utah, and he graciously accepted. After making me beg for what I thought was a little too long, Seth, just FYI. So, Seth, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us. But before you start on the topic, tell us what you do, who you are, and all that jazz.
Well, I just moved to Kirtland, Ohio. I used to be out in Utah working with Carla, which that was crazy, craze, McCraze, right?
It was, and I bet you cry every day that you don't see me all the time now.
I do.
Thank you.
In fact, I was really glad to get to do this podcast because we got to Skype for a little bit with video, and so it got me my Carla fix. So good to see you.
You're one lucky man. So what do you do out in Kirtland?
I've been asked to serve as the historic sites director at the temple in Kirtland.
Oh, wow. And you love that?
Oh, yeah. Love it. I've only been here, you know, a couple weeks now, but this is really a dream job for me. So absolutely love it.
Yeah. And so what's your favorite part of being in Kirtland?
The temple is right there. I can walk to work. I can walk to the temple, and just being so close to the history, which I mean, to these sites that have so much importance, not just for church members in the 1830s, but all the way to the present. So it's just incredible to be here.
And have you always been like a history? I can't decide whether to say buff or nerd. Have you always been interested in history?
I think the correct term is dork, and yes.
Ah. And so what I hear, this might have been your dream job. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Not that I don't love the folks out in Utah, but...
Of course.
You know, of course. I absolutely love history and have worked with historic sites for a couple of years now. I taught for 2 summers, spent some time on the Historic Site Foundation board, and so just to be able to come here and do this, it really is a dream job for me.
Well, Seth, we're super excited for you, and it does sound like a really good move for you since you love history so much. But let's jump back into the topic of the day, which is the reorganization in Utah.
Yeah. So I gave this presentation, and I had 5 major things that I hit on, and the first was just to talk about that there are a whole lot of churches that have come out of the Restoration or are part of the Restoration. So I think most of our listeners will be aware of that, but a lot of times in Utah, people, other than maybe the FLDS, they're not really aware that there have been, you know, multiple different churches that we can trace back to the parent church. So I kind of think of us as one sibling one child of the parent church, and our sibling would, when I say us, I mean Community of Christ. Our sibling would be the LDS church, and then, of course, there's several others. So sometimes we refer to the two churches as cousins, but I think really we are siblings in that parent church, which ended with the death of Joseph Smith, branched off into several different directions.
And when you're talking about this, let's just inform our listeners that we're going to attach a PowerPoint to this podcast, so you can kind of follow along Seth's PowerPoint if you want to. He has some really interesting pictures on his PowerPoint of some different things. And also right now I'm looking at a slide that says schism trajectories. And it talks about all the different, some of the different, not all of them, some of the different schisms from that parent church. So keep going, Seth.
Yeah, and I think Hamer, John Hamer, may have made that slide. I have shamelessly stole it off of Wikipedia, but it's in the public domain. So if you're following along, that's slide three. So after talking about the schisms, I wanted to talk about Second Joseph Smith III in Utah, and then the Utah mission at large. The fourth thing was interactions the Community of Christ has had with the LDS Church. And then I finished this presentation with Community of Christ in Utah today. So I'll just go ahead and give it. To start with Joseph Smith III in Utah, I think it's important to talk a little bit about his history and the fact that he was born in Kirtland. So if any of our listeners have ever been to the Newell K. Whitney store, part of the tour that the LDS missionaries give, well, you can ask, where was Joseph Smith III born? And you'll find, if they know their history, that it was in one of the back bedrooms of the store there. So it's worth pointing out that as the church is developing, Joseph Smith III, I mean, his formative years are mapping alongside the experiences of the early church. So he's born in Kirtland, and then they head to Far West in 1838. And I'm looking at slide number nine, which shows a map of this. And it's actually, if you look at it and you start to think about traveling all the way from Kirtland to Far West in 1838 before the railroad, and Far West is just north of Kansas City area, Independence area, it's quite a trip. I just imagine the impact that leaving your home, I guess I just did that to my kids, huh? But leaving your home and relocating to a new place, right? And the kind of impact that would have had on him. And Carla, you know your history. Far West wasn't exactly a good place to be heading to in 1838.
It really wasn't. It wasn't the best place for them to be, was it?
No, but they felt like it was better and safer than Kirtland, which it probably was. So Kirtland has its own problems that are going on in 1838, but Joseph Smith had started a safety society, which they called an anti-bank. And basically what had happened was a bunch of church members had pumped money into this because Joseph prophesied that the notes would be worth more than their face value. And the bank failed, and a lot of people lost their money, and there are several other theological or doctrinal issues that are going on. And so, it's really sad to see Kirtland's history end this way, but you have a great deal of problems going on in Kirtland. Now, to be fair to Joseph Smith, those notes today are worth more than their face value, just as historic artifacts, so it's kind of one of those ironies that you could have used them for kindling in your fireplace or toilet paper back in 1838, but today they're worth a lot of money.
Do you have some of those notes in Kirtland right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the museum, which is part of the visitor center, we have a whole display case of different notes, including a $3 bill. So, you know, sometimes what's the phrase? You probably know it, Carla, about you're odder than a
$3 bill. Why do you think I know it?
Well, I just figured maybe you had told, you know, somebody said it to you.
What?
Or, I don't.
Yes, I know it. You're odder than a $3 bill, for sure. So,
yeah, we've got it in Kirtland. So anyway, they head to Far West, and then shortly thereafter, about a year later, they end up going to Quincy. Now, Quincy's over the border into Illinois. The state of Missouri was not really happy with members of the church, and so they headed out of state, and Quincy was kind enough to take those folks in. That story of Quincy is actually one of our greatest stories about building Zionic community and how this community reached out to these refugees who, you know, were in that time. I mean, the extermination order said, you need to leave. Exterminate meant you need to leave this place, exterminus. So your religion is so dangerous to us, we are going to kick you out. And here the people of Quincy took us in, which I think in our current climate in the world today. That's a story we ought to go back and look at.
Yeah, that's a, that sounds really beautiful. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. So, and then shortly thereafter, they go from Quincy to Nauvoo in 1839. Now, Nauvoo at that point was a place called Commerce, and they quickly, Joseph's plat for what the city looks like, he lays it down right on top of an existing city, which is what he had done just about everywhere else. But fortunately, in this case, it works, right? For at least for a while, they have a very productive time in Nauvoo as lots and lots of converts come in. So this is Joseph Smith III's life, which is, you know, during his formative years, which had to have a huge impact, especially the fact that his father was killed when he was 11.
Right.
On the 27th of June in 1844. So Joseph Smith III didn't end up going west, obviously, with Brigham Young, and they stuck around in Nauvoo with some travels here and there, but for the most part, they're just in Nauvoo. And you have several different emissaries from the different branches of the Restoration that are coming to Joseph Smith III and wanting him to join them. So he has a vision in 1856, and he is always really careful to qualify his visions, even more so than his father. So it's hard to tell whether this was just a dream or if it was like, you know, what was this? I don't know. But he says that he's out sowing wheat. He's out there sowing wheat with a man named Mr. Yates, and I'll quote, this is slide 13, and our conversation was upon this Utah subject, and the same arguments and statements were repeated by him. To these I was arguing again my reluctance to move, and the question was again presented, why not go to Utah? I paused, rested the bag of grain that I was carrying across my shoulder upon my knee, and turned to answer him. I heard a slight noise like the rush of the breeze that arrested my speech and my attention. I turned my gaze slightly upward and saw descending towards me a sort of cloud, funnel-shaped, with the wide part upward. It was luminous, of such color and brightness that it was clearly seen, though the sun shone in its summer strength. It descended rapidly, and settling upon and over me, enveloped me completely so that I stood within its radiance. As the cloud rested upon the ground at my feet, the words, because the light in which you stand is greater than theirs, sounded in my ears clearly and distinctly. So, and the slideshow has more of that quote from Joseph Smith III, but that last phrase there is worth repeating, because the light in which you stand is greater than theirs. And that really defined how Joseph saw himself in relation to polygamy and to the Utah Church. And, you know, it really that was the early take of the reorganization, that Utah was in apostasy and they were the only ones that had it right. But we could tear this apart on multiple levels, but I really think that in terms of polygamy and in terms of focusing on peace, that Joseph did have greater light at that time. And I'm glad that he sensed that and didn't end up getting sucked up into another movement, but that we were able to have his leadership in the reorganization.
Because let's be honest, it could have been a really easy thing for him to do, is to go west and to say, this is where I can be. And this is where I can be of service. He did choose a path that was very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, the fact that he has this vision, it gives credence to being prophetic. You know, a lot of times we talk about being prophetic as a exercise of being focused on justice that leads to peace. And yet, really, you can't have prophetic without profit, right? Like, there is that sense of connection to the Spirit and to God's will. And it's that drives you to seek for justice and to establish peace.
Wow. Well, I was going to say what you said earlier is that, it seems like that statement, because the light in which you stand is greater than theirs, has kind of been, was part of our movement for a really long time. Like, that did define who we were for a long time. And it was probably necessary in, what was this, 1856, for him to have this. I mean, it was very necessary for people to say, okay, this is the guy I'm going to follow then.
Yeah. Yeah, as you were saying that, it reminded me of the recent words that we have in the Doctrine and Covenants about that former council was necessary for an earlier body to have cohesion. But today we can understand that others can have light, and that's not a threat to us.
Oh, very well said. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you basically said it. I just heard it.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, continue.
So I thought it was really interesting how these visions, or this vision of Joseph Smith III, compared with what is often termed the Grove experience, or the first vision. So both of them are wondering, both Joseph Jr. and Joseph III, they're wondering, what church should I join? There is a pillar or a cloud of light that's brighter than the noonday sun in their accounts. And in many ways, that defines their life's work, or it becomes a way of defining their life's work. So I have to be careful. You know, the first vision account is very important for Mormons today. Historically, though, we don't see it as central to Joseph's teachings and understandings of himself. But it became a way that people understood his calling and his commission. And it may very well be that it did have that grounding. And sometimes it just takes a while for people to think through and systematize, you know, when they have this fire hose of revelation coming, like what were the key events and the touchstones as the movement was developing. So,
yeah, very cool.
Yeah. So after that vision of Joseph Smith III, two sets of missionaries come and visit Nauvoo. One set is from Utah, Elders George A. Smith and Erastus Snow, and they invite Joseph to come to Utah, and he says, thanks, but I'll wait for the train. That's not a direct quote, but like literally that's what he tells them. I'm going to wait for the train to come out. And they're really dismayed because they're like, no, we want you to come out right away. Like, you know, let's get in the wagon and let's just go.
Right.
And no, I'm going to wait for the train. And then another set comes from what was then known as the New Organization. They were a collection of congregations that had chosen not to follow Brigham Young, and their leaders, two of their leaders, had revelatory experiences that said, rather than go to Utah, you just need to stay where you're at, stay faithful, and in due time, a descendant of the prophet will come forward to lead the movement, and we can reorganize the church from there. And so two reps from this group come to him, Elder Samuel Gurley and Edmund Briggs. And when they first show up, Joseph Smith III says, quote, the reception that these brethren met was not a flattering one. And the reason for that is because Elder Briggs was just thundering at Joseph Smith III that he had to accept. You are called of God. You have this duty. There are saints that are scattered and waiting for you to step forward, and you have to do this. And Joseph Smith III didn't want to hear it. He says, I almost turned these messengers out of doors. You know, I guess, well, if you're going and tell somebody that you have a vision for them, maybe you should stop to listen to what they're thinking. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I guess today we might say this approach was more mission to instead of mission with. They went with a message, and he was supposed to submit. But fortunately, the other elder, Elder Gurley, found a quiet space that he could talk to Joseph Smith III personally. And then he worked with him. He stayed there in Nauvoo and worked with him for almost a year before Joseph Smith III accepted a role in this new organization, which becomes the Reorganization, or the RLDS Church, which today, since 2001, has been Community of Christ.
I don't know, Seth. I kind of feel like they played it exactly right. We have a good cop. We have a bad cop. And right? Look what ended up happening. So maybe they had planned that going in.
Well, that's what, when you and I were out on missionary assignments, you were the bad cop, right? And I was the good cop? At least that's how I always thought.
No. Wait. I'm Elder Briggs?
Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe I'll take that. So what really surprises me, though, is that more people from these different schisms didn't come and talk to him. Was it only these two?
No, there were others that would have loved for Joseph III to join in, but in his memoirs, these were the two. And really, he's writing his memoirs as an older adult looking sure. back. So the shape of his life's work has been the reorganization, which has very much been pitted against the LDS Church. And so, he's setting it up this way. But there were, there was interest in any of the Smith family, from James Strang and his organization and others. But Joseph Smith III was very cautious. And again, you think of the history, seeing his father killed, seeing friends turn into enemies, and all the problems that came about in Nauvoo, where Zion becomes hell on earth. He was very, very cautious not to repeat that, or not to get sucked into something. And then in the reorganization, he takes some intentional steps to avoid the reorganization falling into the same traps that were there in Nauvoo. And so our peace emphasis very much is a response to Nauvoo.
Yeah, which I have always really appreciated about Joseph Smith III, how thoughtful he was and how patient and he was. And so that's one thing that I really, so I guess what you're saying is that he's a product of his time and his growing up experience. It makes a lot of sense.
But it's more than just like a knee-jerk thing. He's thoughtful enough to chart another course. And so, and let me give you an example. So Nauvoo is the reason there's such a large militia, or, the Nauvoo Legion there, is because Joseph Smith Jr. is trying to avoid the same problems that they had in Missouri. So mobs assaulted us in Missouri, drove us out. So we're going to build a militia so that doesn't happen again. So both Junior and the Third are responding, to previous issues, but Joseph chooses that we're going to undo violence with the potential for even greater violence. And that's very much, I think, being a product of your time, where Joseph Smith the Third says, no, I'm going to do a non-complementary behavior. When we are threatened with violence, I'm going to find ways to de-escalate it. I'm going to completely remove any threat from both sides. And that, in my mind, that's truly prophetic. So while I value Joseph Smith Jr., I look to Joseph Smith III as the realization of what prophetic leadership is in the Restoration, and just within, our version of the Christian tradition. So for me, Joseph Smith Jr. is like John the Baptist. He's a forerunner. He's proclaiming that fire is going to come down from heaven. It's a very violent apocalyptic vision. And Joseph Smith III takes the course of Jesus, who says, no, the fire actually comes in, cleanses us. We become peaceful within so that then we can act peacefully throughout the world.
Oh, wow. That's a really interesting way to look at those two. That's I'm going to have to process that for sure. But keep going with the story. What happens now?
So Joseph Smith III shows up to a general conference in Amboy, Illinois, on the 6th of April, 1860. And he says, I do not care to say any more at present, but I will simply add that if the same spirit which prompts my coming prompts also my reception, I am with you. And what's beautiful is that, you have this young man, really a young adult, showing up and saying, the Spirit has prompted me to be here. You have called. I have heard. I am responding. I don't know. I think it's just a beautiful piece to that sense of vocation, which comes from the Latin for to call. But it's not just enough for me to sense that that I have, I'm being called. I have to also call others. I mean, there's vocation, I guess, what I'm getting at, it goes in many directions. And, if somebody has a sense of calling, then that really is a sense to then go out and call others to join in that same work. So he shows up and he says, yes, here am I. and here are you, and I hope that we can all, under the same spirit, come together. And of course, they accept him unanimously.
Yeah, he came with, it sounds like from the statement, he also came with this deep sense of vulnerability. And he said, you know what? I'm willing, but if you are not willing, then let's find someone who is in some ways, you know? So that's really cool. And he's only 27 at this time, right? Something like that?
Yeah, yeah. I'm forgetting the, I'm going to be honest, I'm terrible at math, Carly. You're the bishop, you tell me.
I only did 11 years old in 1844, and then I added 16. That's all I did, so I think he's 27.
You're awesome.
Oh, gosh.
All right, so the third part was Joseph Smith III's arrival in Utah, the third part of this presentation. And if you go to slide 20, I have a great picture of the railway station in Ogden, Utah. It's no longer standing. It's been replaced. But this picture is the one that he would have arrived at. So long history of trains and Utah and why Ogden got the railway station. And I'm not going to go into all of that. But this was a very important hub for late 19th century Utah. And as he arrives, he's thinking of the fact that he has so many friends that he's going to be meeting again. And he says, and I quote, "We remembered that they held many articles of faith and belief in common with us. Some were relatives and others were acquaintances who were once friends. Were they so still? We were on an errand antagonistic to the genius of their institutions and their social bond. What could we expect from them? These thoughts and many more of a similar nature occupied us as we passed successively Farmington, Kaysville, Centerville, and Woods Cross." So, I should say with those towns, if you're not familiar with Utah, those towns are the towns from Ogden into Salt Lake. So he's thinking these thoughts as he's traveling, gotten off the transcontinental train, and now he's traveling down into Salt Lake. And he continues his words, "The ride of 40 miles seemed short, and soon we found ourselves in the strange city of a strange people." I absolutely love that. "In the strange city of a strange people, and domiciled at the home of Brother Reinzimar. There we had leisure to think and determine our course. For a number of days we visited places and people in the city, all the while endeavoring to discover a solution to our puzzle. What shall we do? What stand shall we take?" Pretty fascinating stuff, especially for somebody who has been assigned, you know, to Utah. I'm sure, Carla, having grown up Community of Christ your whole life, that you can sympathize with what Joseph Smith III was going through as he arrived into Salt Lake.
Well, actually, in a lot of ways, I think I can. Not only I think Utah is a really interesting place with interesting people, but, you know, coming from the Midwest where you can see for hundreds of miles out here to Salt Lake where you're surrounded by mountains, even that part is completely, it takes you aback because it is such a different scenery than I was ever used to growing up. So in some ways, I traveled just like Joseph Smith III from Independence, Missouri, kind of, to Salt Lake City. So Joseph Smith III and I have a lot in common.
We ought to go to the train station up in Ogden and just imagine what it would have been like, you know, to get off the train back then and, you know, and reconnect with that place that he was at as well.
It probably would have been pretty, I don't know if scary is the right word or intimidating, or it would have been very difficult, I think, for him. And I can't even imagine what he would be going through. You know, the idea that he's going to be seeing some of his old childhood friends, lots of people who knew his father, it would be very hard.
Well, and you got to remember, too, that when he arrives, Utah is a very wild place. So, you know, it's still the West. And even though it may not have been as wild as a place like Deadwood, South Dakota, or some of the other, you know, lawless towns of the Wild West, still, Joseph Smith III had a pistol in his pocket as he preaches for the first time at Union Fort, which today we call Fort Union in Salt Lake. So there's a ward house that was there. It's still standing in that shopping complex. And he had a pistol in his pocket. I mean, this is a scary place to be.
Right. Because he might not even be sure how they're going to welcome him, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
Well, and it doesn't help. I mean, the good news today is we're not out knocking on doors or trying to stir up trouble. We just meet with people who come to church and want to talk about Community of Christ. But he came with a mission that was completely antagonistic. So, you know, that there's got to be a great deal more anxiety than anything that we would experience today, just because of the orientation of the two churches being against each other. Right. So for all his genius on overcoming the violence of Nauvoo, he still had not overcome the problems with interdenominational fighting.
Sure.
So, but I think we learned the lessons. He may not have seen it, but he laid the seeds, and of course he's come right out of the teachings of Christ. But we learned lessons that maybe he wasn't ready to implement. Kind of like the founding fathers of the United States saying, you know, that all men are created equal while they have slaves. Like, it took further generations to figure it out, because we don't always see our blind spots.
Right. And Seth, what year was this? What year did he make the trip out to Utah? Do you know?
He arrives in 1875 after the Transcontinental Railroad was completed, just like he said he was going to come by train. So I love that he kept his word on that. I am not going out in a wagon,
right,
is basically what he said. And it's also because he didn't intend to stay. They wanted him to come out to stay, and he's like, no, I'm taking the train. So it'd be like if somebody comes over to your house and doesn't take off their coat.
Ah, yes. Gosh, I just can't even imagine. That's pretty awesome. Thanks for that story. So moving on, we're talking about the Utah mission. So there are Community of Christ people, or at the time RLDS people, who ended up settling here in Utah, right?
Yes. Well, it's a little more nuanced than that, but yeah, the easy answer is yes. So I, during my presentation, because it was in Utah County, I talked about the origins of the reorganization in Utah County, and I'm just going to follow that PowerPoint. But there were earlier efforts in Salt Lake. But let's go to Utah County and talk about some of the very first members of the reorganization. So the very first meeting was held March 18th, 1894. I'm on slide 24, and it was held at the home of Hannah Reese. Now, I can't prove this definitively, but I think that this was my third great-grandmother. So it's really interesting that I grew up in the LDS church, and yet Hannah Reese, if she's my grandmother, she ended up joining the reorganization after she had children, and one of those children didn't join, and that's how I came through an LDS side. So I have members of the family in both churches because of that.
Interesting. But, gosh.
Yeah. So they met at her house to organize a Sunday school. And they had a lot of people who were interested because of they were disaffected over polygamy. So a lot of the immigrants that were coming across, especially from Europe, the UK primarily, had no clue that polygamy was going on. They show up to Utah. They've been taught a very basic restoration message, and all of a sudden polygamy is everywhere. And so early RLDS missionaries, they had all sorts of people interested in them. In addition to the Reeses who were interested, there was another family by the name of the Carters. We still have Carters in the church today in Utah and elsewhere. The very first Carter who joined, his name was John H. Carter, and he was on Brigham Young's second wagon company. He was really important because he was a blacksmith in both Nauvoo and Utah. So he was helping with the wagons and with all the equipment that it takes to get across the plains. So he came out in that second company, which was reserved just for key people. And he ended up founding the Cartersville area that's in Utah County, right between Orem and Provo, like right in the heart of Orem and Provo where they meet. So very important early pioneer in the area and very important early church member for the reorganization. When he was a polygamist, which is really interesting. He had two wives, but when he heard the missionaries from the RLDS church preach, he said, "I have found the original church." And so there was obviously some disaffection that was going on. He goes home. He tells his family, I found the original church again. And what ends up happening is his second wife becomes the aunt, right? That's what the kids called her. He took care of her, but he no longer lived with her as a wife. So he got a home for her down the road, took care of her financially. They were still family, but they were no longer husband and wife. So he just had a point.
Wow, and we still have Carters in the Community of Christ today, don't we?
Yeah. Yes, yes, we do. So I don't think he would care. We got our camp caretaker in Utah, Riley Carter, who is a descendant. I think John was his great-grandfather. So, and then there are several others in Colorado and in California and other places. The very first building that was built in Provo in Utah County was built in 1899. It's at 240 West and 400 South. So if you want to go see it, it's a home now. Originally, it was brick. And from what I read, the year that it was built, 1899, was a stone was cut, and up in the eaves it was up there, but now it's been stuccoed over and you can't see it. So if the homeowners are listening to me, you need to go up there, get somebody who knows what they're doing, and take that stucco down so that you can see that original stone. This is 1899, because that's really cool.
That is really cool.
Yeah. So they were there for quite a while, and eventually they ended up building a church on about 9th East and 14th South in Orem. And what's really interesting is this church was unique because it was a hexagon. So it was built in 1969, which 69 is a good year to build weird-shaped buildings.
True.
And it definitely had that look to it. And then we used it until 2010, give or take. We ended up selling it, and unfortunately the property was worth more without the building, and the building had some structural issues, so the building was razed and it was just sold recently. And now in Utah County we have what we call a house church, which means we normally meet in homes, but in this case we're able to find a place at the Masonic Lodge that's in Provo, right off of Cartersville Road, right by it. So I love that connection to John Carter. But we were able to rent out space at that Masonic Lodge. And Carla, you can correct me if the dates and times have changed, but we meet on first and third Sundays there at 4:30.
Oh, right? You're so close. The second and fourth Sundays at 4:30. You're so close.
Oh, that's right. That's right. First and third is up in Logan.
Correct.
Yeah. Was that a plant? I don't know. So, first and third up in Logan, second and fourth at Orem, Utah County Community of Christ. So, and we got a pretty good group there.
We sure do. It's pretty fun.
Yeah. RLDS presidents of the church, so two prophets of the church came out and celebrated the 50th and the 60th anniversaries of the Provo branch. So Israel A. Smith came out for the 50th, and then W. Wallace Smith for the 60th anniversary. And I found some newspaper articles that said that there were so many people, so many Mormons who wanted to see grandsons of Joseph Smith Jr. that they couldn't fit them all in the building. So they rented out a space and got a tent, and all these people came out for the anniversaries.
Yeah, I can imagine they would be pretty popular, those two.
Yeah. Well, and I've got two pictures of them on slide 30. All right. So, like I mentioned, though, I wanted to talk about Utah County first, but in reality, that Provo branch was just one of many. When the first missionaries arrive in Utah, they're able to establish many, many congregations. So all the way from Soda Springs and Malad up in Idaho, all the way down to Richfield and Beaver down in southern Utah. I haven't found anything about the beginnings of the St. George congregation. But for the most part, I mean, there were congregations throughout the state. So, we can count about 16 or more congregations. And the amazing thing is these congregations would fill up with people who didn't want anything to do with polygamy. And then as soon soon as the roads were clear in the spring, they would disappear. So their membership numbers are constantly going up all the way through the winter and the spring, and then they go down to zero, and all you got left is the two elders assigned to the branch, and then the numbers go back up. And that, you know, the 1870s was the period that we saw the most most members of the LDS Church join the reorganization in Utah. A lot of them, though, like I said, they just ended up going either to California or they headed to the Midwest. So many of them would have made the trip across the trail twice, which is crazy. They were called backtrackers. To make that transcontinental trek twice is just it blows my mind to do it once, let alone twice. So
yeah, that you would choose to do it. Oh gosh, I can't even imagine. So yeah. When the roads cleared, they would literally leave the state. Like they would just get out of town.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so there are family stories that people didn't feel safe if they joined the reorganization. And as a historian, I'm a phenomenologist. And what that means is I take what they're saying as data. So they felt that they were not safe. I don't have any proof that, in fact, those threats were ever carried out against any member of the reorganization. There is one or two stories about pistol shots, you know, being fired in the direction of people who had joined the reorganization. But the honest truth is, back in this time period, everybody was packing, and there were a whole lot of bullets that were flying around. So I can't, I'm not going to say definitively that it was, your life was at risk if you joined the reorganization. But I will say that they felt that way. And so that feeling is worth documenting, that that they felt like they had to leave. It was a very different time and place, though. Fortunately, you know, relations between the two churches are much, much better now. And obviously, you know, Utah is not doesn't have that Wild West feel to it anymore. But yeah, back in the day, there are family legends, and I'll use that word legends, about wrapping your wagon wheels so that you didn't make any noise as you headed out of town. They just didn't feel safe. So, and I want to be really careful and say nobody was being killed. And we don't have any definitive proof of threats. All we have is their sense of well-being.
And the fact that as soon as the roads cleared, they all got out. Or not all of them, they got out. That makes, that says something. You're absolutely right. We don't know exactly what it says, but it says something.
Well, and I can imagine, you know, if you had been a polygamist, staying would have been really, really hard. Or if you were in a place where everyone was focused on polygamy and then you joined a church that was against it, yeah, you know, it's going to be very hard to stay in that place.
Right, especially when you're a minority, like that much of a minority, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and anybody who's interested in this, go and read about the Mormon Reformation and Jedediah Grant and just some of the things that were going on in Utah during that time period. So it was a pressure cooker. It was a religious pressure cooker. So, you know, if you left because you didn't like the pressure and you didn't like the teachings, you left the church, you're likely to want to leave the state as well, because you would be surrounded in this pressure cooker.
Yeah.
So the first missionaries for the reorganization show up 1863, not long after Joseph Smith III had taken leadership. They arrived on 7 August. They were denied access to any public buildings or churches, so they were just meeting in homes. And they had their first baptism about a month after they arrived, just shy of a month. And they organized at that point the Great Salt Lake City branch, which is the forerunner to the Salt Lake City congregation. That what was going on, though, was just part of a larger missionary outreach that the reorganization was going and trying to find what they called lost and scattered saints. And one of those missionary efforts, and they were trying to find new people too. One of the missionary efforts involved two former Utah folks, so Charles Wandell and Glaude Rogers. They had been in Utah. They had joined the reorganization, and then they left on a mission to Australia, but they had boat trouble, so they ended up in Tahiti, And Carly, you probably know this story about discovering a group who were singing the Spirit of God like a fire is burning, but they were singing it in Tahitian.
Right.
So a lot of church members from Tahiti today, they stem from the fact that these two missionaries connected with them and then connected them to the reorganization because they had just been kind of forgotten. So we have a lot of Tahitians in the church, a lot of people throughout French Polynesia.
We do. And I am shocked by how many members we have in French Polynesia. I don't know the exact statistics, but I know it's probably more per capita than we have almost anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And what I love is that these two missionaries came out of Utah. So Salt Lake City congregation is, you know, sending out missionaries that then make this huge impact. So again, you know, vocation is, when you're called, you also call others, and they had a huge impact on the reorganization.
Thank goodness for boat trouble.
Yeah. So Joseph Smith III, he gets to Utah in 1875. So he's, about a decade after, 12 years after the first missionaries. The first missionaries weren't allowed to speak in public buildings, but this is a high-profile figure. And so just because of who he is in relation to his father, he's allowed to speak in public places. But he is met with opposition. So like when he speaks for the first time at that Union Fort Ward House, they have on the front pew all these women who say that they are plural wives of his father. So, you can imagine how unnerving that would be. Okay. It's kind of like, during the playoffs, the NBA playoffs years ago, somebody got the bright idea to get those big pool noodles and other things to just wave when the opposing team is trying to do
a free throw.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, right? We're going to distract you as much as possible when you're right on the line. So,
are you picturing the plural wives being waved as somewhere in the crowd? Something like this?
Well, they're right in the front.
They
are supposed to disrupt him and get him flustered at the first time he's speaking. So as Joseph Smith III arrives in Utah and he's there speaking at the Union Fort Ward House, he said that on the inside of the mantle of the door as he walks in, somebody had scribbled, "Brigham lives, the kingdom grows, the stone is rolling, mind your toes."
Oh, gosh.
I love it. My favorite quote ever.
Wait, say it again.
Okay. So it says, "Brigham lives, the kingdom grows, the stone is rolling, mind your toes.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
So, and I have to wonder, was he invited to speak there because there were some folks that maybe were out of step with Brigham and they're, it's a little microaggression to write something like that. So, because it's odd that he got to speak in a ward house. But anyway, just an observation we'll never be able to prove. But yeah, what a great quote.
It is a great quote. And the fact that it rhymes makes it even more fun.
Yeah. I think I'm going to write it in the door frame of my office here in Kirtland and then paint over it. So I'm the only one that knows it's there.
Wait, that'll really get them.
Oh, it's on a podcast. Oh, well. So, his first public speech, so the first time he gets to, go before a large group, because Union Fort was out in the middle of nowhere back then. First time in Salt Lake speaking was at a place called the Liberal Institute. This had been established by William S. Godbey, one of my favorite figures from church history. So the Godbeyites were we call them a liberal offshoot of Mormonism that goes... That part, I like, that they were calling for progress, but then they go the direction of spiritualism. So the Liberal Institute that Godbey founded, Godbey had a lot of money, and he was a very successful merchant, and so he funded a lot of things like the Liberal Institute, which was dedicated on the 2nd of July in 1871, and this was no small thing. Susan B. Anthony actually spoke during the dedication.
Wow.
So it was a place that you could go and hear alternate voices within Salt Lake City back in the 1870s. And its founding figures, in addition to Godbey, include E.L.T. Harrison, Eli B. Kelsey, and Amasa Lyman, which if Mormon history, Utah history. Those are big names. I like the Eli B. Kelsey because Benjamin Kelsey is a friend of ours, member of the Salt Lake congregation, a direct descendant, and named after Eli B. Kelsey. So Joseph Smith III, his brothers David and Frederick, they both preached at the Liberal Institute repeatedly. That building gets sold a few years later, and it's sold to the Presbyterians, who turn it into Westminster College, which I have to give a shout out because that's my alma mater. So that's where Westminster starts. So I've got some great pictures. If you're on the slideshow on page 38, you can see the Liberal Institute. Slide 39 is Godby's Octagon Mansion. So octagon buildings were really in style back then. You were somebody if you had an octagon mansion. So they're like right next to each other. And so we're meeting in the Liberal Hall. We're also renting out spaces. But what's really cool is that our very first church building is right across the street from Godby's Octagon Mansion. So just right around the corner from the Liberal Institute. And you can see that on slide 46. So unfortunately, the trees in this photo are obscuring our building. But I did a lot of hunting, and I won't go into all the details, but if you go into the slideshow, you can see. But I was able to find a picture of our original building in Salt Lake, which I think had been lost. That this picture of Salt Lake, the Salt Lake congregation, had been lost to time, and yet I found it in the archives. So, and I literally started jumping up and down and yelling in the archives, Utah State Historical Archives, and people were like, "Hey, dude, you need to sit down and be quiet."
Yeah, it can't be that exciting, and you're like, "It is," because it is cool, and that's on slide 41. 43.
So you can see a drawing of it on slide 47, and we always had the drawing, but we didn't have a picture, but I found a photo of it on slide 50, and then I zoomed in, and then I compare it to the drawing, and you can clearly see that it is the same building.
Oh, right. So,
very, very exciting to find that, but it was too noisy and on that street, so they moved out, which is really sad. Because it's in the heart of downtown Salt Lake, and I would give anything to have that building back.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Well, it'd be worth a ton based on the location. It's near 2nd South and 2nd East.
Oh, yeah.
So they ended up in 1913. So they bounced around a little bit, but they ended up getting their own church building that they bought in 1913. Oh, but I got to back up for 2 seconds. I found out from the historian of the historic Salt Lake 10th Ward, that our people, for a short time before they bought the new 1913 building, that they were meeting in the schoolhouse that the 10th Ward owned, which is crazy that you had them worshiping. Literally, it's a complex. It's the same building. They you know, it's right next to each other. So they were worshiping right side by side with the 10th Ward, which is one of the original wards in Salt Lake City. So I wish I had more history on that. I asked my friends with the LDS Church who work with their history department if there was anything within the ward minutes, but so far we haven't found anything to talk about that. But that's just a fascinating look into what life was like for folks who didn't end up going to the Midwest, you know. And I wonder what they had to say about each other being in such close quarters. I guess the fact that they bought a building of their own, you know, a few years later says something. But it wasn't brand new. It was a Lutheran church. It was called Trinity Lutheran. Today it's a sushi place. So if you've ever been to Ikebon Sushi in Salt Lake City, it's on 4th East and 336 South. If you go there, it's a beautiful church inside. And that's where we met from 1913 to 1965.
Oh, that's amazing.
It is. Have you been there?
I haven't.
No, you need to go. They do have stuff that's fried if you don't like raw fish. Are you a raw fish sushi person?
Oh, I can kill it for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, go.
Okay.
They have an appetizer there that's it's fried tofu, and it's got this really delightful dipping sauce. It's like coconut and sweet red chili. You should go. You really should.
And it's in a church.
And it's our old building.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, it's so cool. I love to go in there. So, again, another building I wish we still had, but we sold it in 65. It was getting old, and we ended up building in 1965 the Salt Lake City congregation, we're still there. So the building just had its 50th anniversary. Gorgeous building design. It has, you know, it's 50 years old. It has a few issues, but it still is a very beautiful building, very well done. And what I love about the story is that part of the footprint that Salt Lake congregation occupies now was either owned by or was right next to the property of Gordon B. Hinckley, who was the president of the LDS Church in the 90s and into the 2000s. Well, back in the 60s, he still was a pretty big leader within the church, and his fellow neighbors were trying to oppose the Community of Christ building there on their property, or right next to their property. And he told all the neighbors, look, I have trouble everywhere I go building Mormon ward houses because I get opposed by the neighbors. We are not going to do that in our own neighborhoods. So really nice story of cooperation.
A great story. A really good story. That's awesome to hear. So Gordon B. Hinckley lived in the neighborhood where the Salt Lake congregation is right now.
Yeah, he was the stake president in that stake. And it looks like, I'm looking at the slideshow, slide 72. It says property next to our LDS chapel. So I think what happened was somebody went in, a representative of the church, probably John Bradley, who was a 70 in that time in Utah, bought the lot, and then the neighbors found out what they were going to use it for, and they all tried to oppose it, and Hinckley said, no, don't. So really great story, and it's one of many stories. So on slide 71, I've got a great picture of Fred M. Smith standing next to Heber J. Grant, so the two church presidents, and this was taken at the auditorium in Independence. There have been some really great moments where the two churches have put aside problems going back all the way to the 1840s and just said, hey, look, like, we have more in common. We have too much in common to not come together. So, and to celebrate our shared history. So that was that's a great snapshot into interactions between the two churches. And there are, there are many, many of those, especially within the historical community when the church in Utah has connected with the LDS Church, and we've done good things for the community and for the restoration at large. So I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Ogden congregation as well. I'll be honest, I don't know the history of the Ogden congregation as well, but there has been a congregation up there since the very earliest efforts. The building is on Washington Street, I believe, in Ogden, and it has moved a few times. They literally have picked the building up and moved it. So, but it's an old white Gothic church that sits up on the hill, and it's a wonderful little community that we have there, and is growing as well. So, that's where our caretaker Riley Carter goes to church. So. Yeah.
It is an adorable little church building. It is so cute.
Yeah, and great little community there. So a lot of history there as well. And then I mentioned up in Logan, we have a house church up there that meets at the Whittier Community Center on 1st and 3rd Sundays at 4:30. Thanks
for that. You got it.
Yeah. So... that is, well, and I should also, I mentioned the old St. George congregation. We also recently celebrated the 1 year anniversary of Southern Utah Community of Christ. So, myself and Robin Linkhart and Emily Rose, all have, worked with the folks down there, but I got to give a ton of credit to them as well. I mean, this congregation, was built by its seekers as much as anybody else. So they got together and they said, we want to be a congregation. We want to be a community of Christ. And they made it happen. And Brittany Mangelson just did a great podcast with Nancy Ross about the history of things down in the Southern Utah Congregation of Community of Christ. So if you haven't heard that one, I highly recommend that podcast. So that's another great, great group in Utah. And yeah, I'm excited that I, you know, had a chance to be there at the one-year anniversary and to take part in establishing that group and just to see the community there that has grown and how it's been healing and powerful for them and for me.
So. You have made history there. You're part of history now.
I know. It's kind of cool, right?
Yeah, it's really cool.
So that was my presentation on the history of the reorganization in Utah. And, you know, we've started a new chapter, Carla, with you there as well as Blair White. And I'm looking forward to seeing the history continue to be written. You know, the great thing about history is people, and, you know, we write the story in every time we connect lives together.
Well, sure. So Seth, I thank you so much for the presentation. Thanks for sharing with us and for finding all those cool pictures and for giving us like a really well-rounded view of what and how the church started here in Utah. So do you have any favorite stories that you didn't get a chance to share? Or is there anything that you wanted to say and you're like, oh, shoot, I really wanted to say that, but I forgot. I'm giving you free rein to figure out what you missed.
Jesus lives, the kingdom grows, the stone is rolling. Mind your toes.
Amen.
Let's see, do I have any other good stories about the church in Utah that I didn't share? You know, for the sake of time, I'm going to say no, but I will encourage people to read Pragmatic Prophet by Roger Lanius. And it talks a lot about Joseph Smith III's experience in Utah, including, so here's some teasers, no spoilers. There was a period when government officials wanted Joseph Smith III to be the governor of the state of Utah. And also some of the connections that Joseph Smith III made with other denominational leaders in the state of Utah, as well as tensions. And I had mentioned my alma mater, Westminster College. They were similar to the reorganization in that time period because they felt like they had to go and fight against polygamy. So they founded Westminster College, and they said, any Mormon who wants to come gets free tuition. So the school was associated with the denomination up until, I think, 1975. Today it is an incredibly liberal school. It's one of the best schools, actually, in the West, and I loved it there. But there's this great interaction between Joseph Smith III and Presbyterian leaders when Joseph is invited to sit on the stand at an event in Utah, and the Presbyterians freak out because, you know, he's not Christian enough for them, and here we are inviting up the son of the prophet. So lots of great stories like that, and definitely check it out so that you can read about potential, you know, the nomination for the potential nomination of Joseph Smith III for governor. And Lanius has another great article that I don't know if people can find anymore, but it's about the history of the reorganization in Utah, where he talks about especially the time period in the 1870s when about 2,000 to 3,000 people end up joining the reorganization and heading to the Midwest. So, yeah. So that's it.
Well, that's awesome. Now that I live here in Utah, I find this stuff incredibly fascinating. I hope that those who do not live in Utah also find it fascinating. Those history, what do we call it? History
of the Reorganization in Utah is what I titled it. I think you titled it History of Community of Christ in Utah, but either one works, right?
Well, thank you so much for telling us about, you know, more about Joseph Smith III than I knew before, which I really always appreciate, and about perhaps what people had to go through as being the RLDS or the Reorganization or Community of Christ out here in Utah. I am just astounded when I think about history and when I think about maybe what I would have done in that situation, and it just blows my mind how that people stuck around and stayed, even though they may or may not have been intimidated, may or may not have been very stressed out to be here. I just think it's amazing that what people go through.
Yeah. Well, and I love telling the history so that we can point out that look at how much better things are today between the two churches, and how, you know, that sense of threat obviously is long gone, but also the sense of having to say we're the one true church and you're not, and that fighting back and forth. So if anything else, the history of the church of Community of Christ in Utah is one of peace and reconciliation.
That's true. I mean, nobody ever wins the fight of we're the one true church. There's never a winner out of that fight. So it's really cool that we can come to a place where we don't need to do that anymore.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, thanks again, Seth. Thanks again for your knowledge and for your sense of fun in telling the history. And I appreciate hearing your voice.
Well, it's good talking to you. Give all my love to everyone out there in Utah. So, and you guys take care.
The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.